Well, happy Thursday to you. Welcome to Perspectives from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Before we get underway, a reminder, you are always invited to be part of the proceedings via phone and email. You can give us a call, 850-414-1234, or zip us an email, perspectives@wfsu.org. Oh my gosh, coming off of a really tempestuous weekend and into this week as well. Of course, you know, all the national news we've been following with a great deal of relentless coverage since the incidents in El Paso and Dayton. And then here in our own area, a number of situations just within the past 24 hours relating to the shutdown of the Walmart over in Quincy based on a supposed threat uttered by someone who was coming out of there. We've had some young folks who have gotten themselves in some deep, deep trouble by articulating some not so nice sentiments on social media and a lot more stuff too. But what we're going to talk about today kind of connects in a way to that as a potential solution to some of these situations that involve, especially the criminal activity in Tallahassee that has been so much talked about over the past several years in a political and other contexts too. So coming up on Monday of next week, Monday evening, there's going to be a community conversation on a concept called restorative justice, and that'll take place starting at 7 at Good Samaritan United Methodist Church out on Capitol Circle Southeast. And we have the great honor and privilege to welcome the keynote addresser of that happening today here on Perspectives, giving us a call from his home environment, Mike Butler. He began his 35-year law enforcement career as a patrol officer in Boulder, Colorado, went on to spend 15 years as Longmont, Colorado police chief. He is now that city's public safety chief, and he'll be speaking at next Monday's community conversation here in Tallahassee. Chief Butler, it is an honor to have you, sir. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We'll get into the nuts and bolts and a little preview of what you're going to be addressing here in just a moment. But you're also joined on the phone by an old acquaintance of ours, Second Judicial State Attorney Jack Campbell, on vacation, taking some time out to talk to us. Jack, it's really good to have you on the air, sir. Are you enjoying your vacation otherwise?
Yes, sir, I am. Good to spend some time with some family and getting ready to get back. But this is an important issue, and I'm willing to take some time to join you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again, Jack. We appreciate that. In studio, Florida State University physics professor Dr. Jeremiah Murphy, who's deeply connected to the restorative justice issue through the community connection. Dr. Murphy, good to have you, sir.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here to be talking about this really important topic. And I just want to say, Jack and Mike, thank you so much for being a part of this conversation. You being a part of this just fills me with hope and inspiration. So thank you.
Well, Chief Butler, we could start with you, sir. For the uninitiated, folks who may not know what restorative justice is, can you give us kind of the thumbnail overview or the quick hit definition? What are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about a way of relating that's perhaps different than what we've been used to, especially within the criminal justice system. And there's a number of things that you can do, but I'm just going to back up the phrase restorative justice, and I interchangeably use restorative practice and practices and restorative principles as well. And the principles of restorative justice and restorative practices are focus on relationship, focus on responsibility, focus on repairing the harm, focus on repairing the harm, and focus on reintegration of people back into our community. There are different forces than the ones we're normally used to. Typically, the one that we see out of the criminal justice system is one of retribution, one that's punitive in nature. Restorative justice takes into account more principles, more forces, I think, that are in our midst that we can build around. And so that that's kind of the theory behind it, and there's a lot more, of course. But the way this can be applied and plays out is if someone does commit a crime and there's a victim, that the person who commits the crime and the victim can come together in a facilitated, safe way and basically work out their differences, where the victim in the criminal justice system doesn't have, there's no legal provision for their voice in the criminal, in the restorative justice process. Their voice is the absolute centerpiece. The offender, in the case of restorative justice, has to choose accountability. In the criminal justice system, of course, there's the right to remain silent, a sacred right in our country, but in the restorative justice process, has to admit and take accountability. And so there's a conversation that's facilitated amongst those two. This is one model I'm talking about. There's community representatives. There's often representatives from the local police department. They work out an agreement, a contract. They talk about what that's going to look like in terms of repairing the harm. And then the offender has to complete that contract to the satisfaction of everybody that's in that group. And then there's also a lot of apology and a lot of forgiveness in those circles and those conferences as well. So that's, in essence, one model of a restorative practice. And we call it restorative justice. And we use it here in our community, Longmont, Colorado, in lieu of, and sometimes in complement with, the criminal justice system. So we've done a lot of work with restorative justice over the years, but in essence, that's been the main model we've used.
Okay, if I could ask you, Jack Campbell, how would that kind of concept, of which, as Chief Butler said, there are many variations and iterations that you can take on this, how would that specifically be used to address the particular kinds of problems that we have here in Tallahassee, especially with some of these really persistent crime pockets around town?
Well, we've already been using the restorative justice system, particularly with our juvenile cases. That's often the best way that we can get in. We're running a teen court. We have a lot of different diversionary steps through the Department of Juvenile Justice and our office, where we're able to allow particularly young and not very entrenched criminals to see the damage that they're causing. They hopefully start showing some empathy for what they've done to the community, and it allows some face-to-face interactions. We also have had cases where much more serious, and most notably a homicide, where because of the relations of the victims and the offenders, that we've decided to take that approach. So as a practical matter, we're trying to use it and start this with people before they get too far down the rabbit hole of criminal conduct. We're trying to allow them to both heal as an individual by facing what they've done. We want to make sure, you know, in this state, we just passed a constitutional amendment, most commonly known as Marcy's Law. So empowering victims is very much a priority to the citizens of Florida. And I think restorative justice is yet another way to make sure that we both empower somebody who's been victimized due to no fault of their own, and we can hopefully get better responses and reduce recidivism by requiring the victim or requiring the offender to see what they've done and to face who they've hurt.
Not getting into any specifics, since, of course, these are ongoing investigations right now, so we're not going to drill down into that. But, for instance, the two kids, one in Wakulla, one in Leon, that did the social media stuff within the past day or so about a potential school attack, and if it is found that, you know, there was no anything that could trigger red flags, and these are just, you know, kids essentially being stupid as we all were at around age 13, that might be the type of situation where restorative justice would be indicated rather than something more hardcore, do you think?
You know, like I said, I don't want to get into the specifics of those cases other than to say that everything that we know of this time is there's no pending threat to any of the schools involved or any of our kids. But Yes. With young people like that, I think that often people don't realize the consequences of their behavior. Often people don't recognize, particularly young people, that on a social media forum, that they're able to strike fear. You got people, you know, within the last few weeks, few days, I should say, we've had these mass shootings. And for that to be followed up so closely, that's one of the reasons why we in law enforcement are careful not to glamorize the people who do these horrific acts and these murderers, because you do get often copycats and children who will try to emulate them and you know, try to become famous or at least infamous by making these types of threats, and they don't realize how they're hurting. So I think restorative justice could be a good step. Often, if they were actually to sit down and meet somebody who had been the victim of a violent crime, perhaps they could understand better the damage they do just by making such a threat.
Yeah, that whole idea of victim impact and all, which has become pretty much a standard operating procedure on the part of the criminal justice system in many kinds of situations. Dr. Murphy, we want to get you into the conversation here in just a moment, but we are bearing down on a break, so we will tell everyone who's listening to Perspectives. If you are just joining us, restorative justice is the topic today. We have Chief Michael Butler, who is the public safety chief from Longmont, Colorado, on the phone with us, as we do Jack Campbell, the state attorney for the Second Judicial Circuit, and joined by Community Connections maven Dr. Jeremiah Murphy here on Perspectives. All of this part of the run-up to a community conversation on restorative justice coming up on Monday, this coming Monday from 7 to 9 at the United Church in Tallahassee, Good Samaritan United Methodist Church, rather, on Capitol Circle Southeast. And we will be back with more right here on Perspectives in just a moment. We are back on Perspectives. Hey, you can always find us online at WFSU.org. You can check out this or past Perspectives using that handy-dandy website. Just go to our URL, click on radio, hit local programs, pull down that, and you'll see Perspectives. Boom, you're in. We archive past shows, trying to have the most recent program posted within 24 hours of when it actually airs. And we are joined once again by Chief Michael Butler out in Colorado. He'll be Tallahassee bound before too terribly long. Jack Campbell also on the line, are checking in from vacation. Thanks again, Jack. And Dr. Jeremiah Murphy here from Florida State. Community Connection, let's talk about that first, if we could, Dr. J, and what that is. It's not just a solo project. It's not just you. It's a bunch of folks, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm a volunteer for Community Connections. It's run by Dr. Cindy Bigby and Dan Kahn and Julia Denholm DeMaria. And it's a restorative justice program that's here in town, and they're doing some amazing work. And we volunteers and other people in the community who are excited about their work have formed Friends of Community Connections to help them do their job. But also we have seen the effectiveness of their program, and hopefully we can get into those numbers a little later of how effective these programs are. And we're ready to see this spread across not only our justice system, but also our schools, within our communities. And so that's our mission, is to help spread these kinds of empathy and conflict resolution ideas across our community. I can go into a little bit of detail, like how Community Connections works here.
Yeah, yeah, please do.
From a volunteer's perspective. So actually, let me back up a second, and I kind of want to share a story of something that happened recently that was highlighted in Tallahassee Democrat that kind of sets the context of why Community Connections is so effective. So, you know, we all have heard that not that long ago, a couple of teens and a young man got into an argument over 50 cents, and this tragic argument ended with the tragic death of the young man. As far as I'm aware, I think one of the teens shot the young man. And the obvious question is, how can such a tragedy come from such a seemingly small conflict? And there's a lot of research that actually shows why this comes about. And basically, the brain research shows that when you've had trauma in your life, and especially sustained trauma throughout your life, there's the part of your brain that's designed to determine safety is kind of out of whack. And so when we approach a situation, we're often quick to respond with that lizard brain, with the fight, the flight, or the freeze. And since trauma is everywhere, we all experience some level of trauma, our first reaction is often with our lizard brain. And that is the point of community connections, is they teach us, including the volunteers, how to notice what's going on in that moment when we're reacting, what feelings we're feeling, and then how to not judge our feelings but set them aside and then become more aware of, okay, what are the fundamental needs that are at play here? And then that allows a more authentic dialogue between people, that allows a greater connection, and it often circumvents these violence. And so as a volunteer, there's, you know, something like 15 volunteers and then 15 students that are go into this diversion program that Jack was mentioning earlier. Community Connections is one of these diversion programs. And Community Connections serves about 15 students per cycle, and they have three cycles, so they serve about 45 kids per year. And in short, what these students and the volunteers learn is how to be present, how to understand one another, how to hear one another, so that we can circumvent these processes. In other words, how do we shut down that lizard brain and engage our higher level functioning brain so that we can actually have conversations and connection?
Well, Chief Michael Butler, and I hope you heard everything that Jeremiah was saying there, but it sounds like the whole concept of restorative justice has to kick in long before the incident that leads to the arrest and the conviction and the need for then restorative justice on the back end to repair the damage.
Yes, I really liked what Doctor said. I didn't know about Community Connections in terms of what they did in Tallahassee, but my hat's off to them for getting to that point. And I will tell you that, you know, there's a lot of research and there's a lot of neuroscience that we're also exploring and discovering that lends itself to exactly what Dr. J just talked about. And so restorative practices, restorative principles are very much, as Dr. Jay talked about, in terms of how it can play out in our brains. We're also big followers in Longmont of a guy named Dr. Bruce Perry, who's a neuroscientist that we're actually bringing to this community in November, that's going to basically talk about the part of the brain Dr. Jay talked about, the amygdala, that fight or flight part, where a lot of people who have trauma basically live. And so the idea is, how can you get people who are experiencing that kind of trauma into another part of their higher brain that can cause different kinds of behaviors and less flight or less fight or flight kinds of ways of reacting? So we can go into that later, but restorative practices is very much a part of that aspect. And part of what we do in our restorative processes here, and I just want to make it clear for your listeners that almost all of the cases in our community are referred by police. And so when police officers encounter a case, they refer the case itself. It comes from the police officers themselves. And so we've referred probably over the years 6,000 cases to restorative justice, and that's versus arresting and or summoning people. Because our police officers are typically attached to what draws a police officer to be kind of get involved in this kind of way of doing business versus arresting or summoning people, they're drawn to two things. Number one, accountability. The empathy is a big part of this. There's no question about it. But people who choose accountability and restorative justice typically sustain that accountability at a much greater in a much greater way. Oftentimes, the criminal justice system will demand or legislate kinds of accountability. When people choose accountability, we have found that that's much more sustainable in terms of someone's behavior down the road. And so police officers are drawn to people who accept accountability for their actions and are actually willing to try to figure out how to help people, help them use that accountability. The other thing that police officers are very much drawn to are the plight of the victim. So oftentimes the person who sees the rawest form of what's happening when a crime occurs is the police officer. And so when they see that these victims and their voice counts, their thoughts matter, their humanness is valued in the restorative justice process, that has caused our police officers to really migrate to a new way of doing business in this community that has been very effective and very successful. And it does lend itself to what Dr. J is talking about in terms of what's happening in people's brains. And one of the things that we do with our offenders is we let them know all of the good attributes they have, all the assets and strengths they have. We just don't talk about their behavior and identify them by the act that they're there for. But we also go into great depth, the good they have, the good qualities and the strengths and assets they have as well, which gives them, and oftentimes, just sometimes the first time people have heard this, gives them a sense that they do have worth, they do have value. So I'll end it there, but I do believe that this whole brain science and the research done by neuroscientists, it is something we have to pay attention to in terms of government policies, city policies, school policies, criminal justice system policies, and that if we can align our policies, procedures with what happens in the brain, I think we're likely to be much more successful in preventing certain kinds of behavior, but if the behavior occurs, responding to it more effectively.
Thanks, Chief Butler. And a quick mea culpa here. This community forum is on Monday, August 19th. I'd been saying next Monday. It is not. It is going to be on the 19th. Thank you, Pete. Appreciate your email to make sure that I have that correction. To quickly encapsulate what we've been talking about here on restorative justice, for you, State Attorney Jack Campbell, when you bring in this holistic approach, you're looking at the motivators for someone's misdeed and making sure that they understand that they as a person have value even if they have committed something egregious that has impacted someone else negatively. And you bring in the victims to this, as you mentioned, under the provisions of Marcy's Law, but also under restorative justice to help their healing process. And you get the police involved and all. It sounds so great. And theoretically, it's a wonderful concept, but we also see the kind of budget constraints that you have there in the state attorney's office and the public defender's office and law enforcement and how the dockets are exploding. And how do you make this work for real? This is a lot of time and trouble and effort and presumably extra money that you would have to spend on this. Can you do this?
Well, what's our alternative? We certainly are budgetarily constricted. And I think that's the real challenge. We at the state attorney's office mission is to try to stop recidivism. The fact of the matter is that most of the people that we prosecute are going to rejoin our community. Very few people are going to go away forever. And so we need to recognize that that these people are going to rejoin our community sooner or later. We do need to recognize the fact that the majority of crimes are committed by a small portion of the overall community. So we've got to invest heavy. The criminal justice system is traditionally a reactive system. We don't have the minority report. We're not able to go out there and stop a crime before it happens. So what we have to do is to hopefully isolate people at the beginning of their criminal activity. We try to do it, and generally sometimes you'll have people who will become incredibly violent in their first crime. But generally, people kind of get into the water and they start with minor crimes and work their way up. This is a worthy investment, in my opinion, for us in the criminal justice system, both from the prosecution, from law enforcement, and from the community, where, to me, crime is very much like cancer. You really don't want to have to deal with an amputation. You don't want to have to deal with chemotherapy where you're cutting away people from the community. It's so much better to be proactive and stop smoking earlier on and interrupt the behavior that's causing the adverse long-term result. So yes, it's a definite crunch on it. We would like to see more done. That's where I think that, you know, if you ask me what the number one thing we need in our community, it's case management. Law enforcement's going to be running from call to call. Our prosecutors are, some of them are carrying 300 cases apiece. Our juveniles are over 100 apiece. And so they're not going to have the time to be full-time case managers. They're going to come in and come out of these people's lives. So that's where I think it's great that this radio show is covering this, and we have this forum coming up. And, you know, one of the participants here is a physicist who has decided to spend his good time to come out and give case management on a one-on-one basis with these people who need these interruptions so that we can go ahead and, you know, reroute them away from criminal behavior and make them productive. One of the things I like best about the program he's talking about is that often when the people have gone through the system, they immediately turn around and want to be volunteers and kind of pass it forward and pay it forward. And that's where we need the community to come forward and help us. We can certainly deal with the dangerous. We can deal with the law. I'm not asking for people to do that. But we need, particularly with our juveniles, we need somebody to step in and help them be the gap between, you know, when they get out of trouble and they make sure they get to school, make sure that they get to school with a full stomach, make sure they do their homework, make sure they know what their curfew is, and all those different little things that our parents have done for us. We have a desperate need in our community for people to step in and help fill that gap. And that's where I think restorative justice, once they recognize the empathy, that shows a definite caring for others. And often that the trauma that they're starting with, which we often talk about ACEs, which are adverse childhood experiences, is because people haven't cared about them. And so they lack the ability for that empathy. So I think that this whole movement is valuable because, one, we need people to care for them so that they'll care about themselves and they'll care about others and stop victimizing others.
Dr. Murphy, you are on.
Thank you so much for saying all that, Jack. I really appreciated a lot what you had to say. And I want to reemphasize some of what you said with some numbers as well. But I just wanted to highlight, I really appreciated what you said. What else are we going to do? This is a problem that our entire community is faced with, and we have a solution in our backyard. And I'm looking forward to help Community Connections grow and take on more cases, in fact. So some of the numbers I just wanted to share is that it turns out incarcerating is a really expensive solution. So this is to your question, Tom, about, like, is there money to do this? It costs about $150,000 per year per kid to incarcerate a kid. And if you do nothing but just incarcerate a kid, unfortunately, the recidivism rate, or the rate at which they return back to jail, is about 70-80%. Now, you know, a lot of places, like Jack was saying, have diversion programs. And so working out these exact numbers can be a little tricky. But it looks like if you just do nothing but incarcerate kids, 70-80% of them go back to jail. You know, as a professor, that's a failing grade. Like, so there's got to be a better way to do this. And the specific numbers for Community Connections on their recidivism rate is like 12% or lower. So that's an A. So that's going from a practice that doesn't work to a practice that works remarkably well. And then I just want to reemphasize what Jack said. Probably the biggest measure of success of this program is that 30% of the kids come back as volunteers because they care so deeply that this system, that this process works for them. They have seen it impact their lives. There are parents who come back and they thank the program profusely. You will hear things like, not only has this changed my kid's life, this has changed my life. We have a much better relationship with one another. And it just brings tears to your eyes when you see that kind of appreciation shown. And in fact, it's something like 95% of the kids want to come back to volunteer, but because of various reasons, including poverty, they just don't have the opportunity to come back and volunteer. And so these are teenagers. How often do you get, you know, nearly 100% want to do something and then 30% actually coming back and spending time?
Well, I want to throw a question to Chief Butler here in just a moment, and I'll let him mull this one over if we could, because we're bearing down on a break right now and sure don't want to have to interrupt him in mid-thought here. But Chief, one of our email friends, Betty, wanted to know if law enforcement in any big cities might be buying into the restorative justice approach. We know Longmont, California, I just checked your census estimate. You're around 96,000 population. It's a nice-sized city, but it's not a major metro, just like Tallahassee is kind of like a big, medium-sized city. So we'll address that on the other side of this break that's rapidly bearing down. And again, a reminder that the Faith in Public Life and Law Enforcement Action Partnership is hosting this Restorative Justice Community Forum on Monday, August 19th, a week from this coming Monday, between 7 and 9 o'clock at Good Samaritan United Methodist Church. That's on Capitol Circle Southeast, and that is off of Blairstone Road if you head on out there to Capitol Circle, and that'll be taking place there, with the featured speaker being Chief Michael Butler, who is the Public Safety Chief for the city of Longmont, California. More to come right here on Perspectives after this quick timeout. Don't go away. Restorative justice and the community conversation on that topic coming up on the 19th of this month, a Monday, out there at Good Samaritan United Methodist Church. Back to Chief Michael Butler in Longmont, Colorado, who is the featured keynote for this get-together. And again, Chief, as Betty asked, how many big cities are now relying on restorative justice or some variation thereof as part of their holistic approach to crime management and prosecution and law enforcement and all that?
Yeah, great question. And let me just say that when we talk about what we're talking about, this is this country. Restorative justice is a worldwide movement, and there are literally countries that have adopted restorative justice as a major component of how they're going to deal with this kind of wayward or criminal behavior, including New Zealand, including lots of parts of England, parts of Australia. So it's not just a citywide, but I will say, in terms of her direct specific question, there are large cities that are dabbling and experimenting, because you won't find a criminal justice system professional in this country that's not looking for other ways to be able to address the issues, the social and health issues that every city in America is addressing. And so there are we're kind of a fertile ground, if you will, for another way of being able to do business, because as we've talked about, recidivism rates are so high. And as Dr. Murphy spoke about failing grades versus passing grades, no one wants to deal with the failing grades for a long time. And so the large cities, I can't sit here and name a large city that is exclusively or that is using restorative justice to a great degree, but I will tell you, I'm a part of the Police Executive Research Forum, which includes all the major cities around the country, and there are many police chiefs and sheriffs that are beginning to see the benefit of restorative justice. But I want to get into what the conversation before in terms of how you afford this, and that's how we look at it. We look at it as an add-on to what we're doing versus restorative practices becoming a part of and institutionalized in terms of what we're doing. It's a very expensive operation right now, the criminal justice system. And it's a system that doesn't have a lot of great success. The failure rate is significantly high. And so I know sometimes the question is, why would we want to use restorative justice? My question back to people is, why do we continue to do things that don't work? And so that are highly expensive. So we know what we're doing isn't working. And so I think there are a lot of chiefs, including major city police chiefs, that are in fact beginning to see that there might be some real possibilities with the restorative principles and restorative practices. And by the way, they can play out in a lot of different ways. They can play out in terms of how they deal with addiction. They can play out in terms of how they deal with mental health. They can play out in terms of how we deal with homelessness. And if you talk to any community or if you of any size in this country, they will tell you that those health and social issues take up a tremendous amount of public safety resources in any one community. And the residuals of mental health issues, the residuals of addiction, the residuals of homelessness can often end up in criminal behavior. And so restorative practices and principles can be applied in those arenas as well, not just the criminal behavior, but also folks who are struggling with those particular health issues. So I know I went beyond the question, but I just wanted to get that part in.
No, thanks, Chief. Appreciate that. But even beyond the financial ramifications on here, and we do have one politician with us in this discussion, Jack Campbell, there are also political realities of this whole situation and what you have to respond to, as well as our elected sheriff, Walt McNeil, and whomever will ultimately take over the full-time job at the Tallahassee Police Department. There's some politics involved in there, too, certainly. And when you have folks who maybe are calling for quick solutions, we have a crime problem. Do something and do something quickly. And restorative justice is a little bit more circumspect, a little bit more thoughtful. It takes more resources and involvement to really get those numbers perhaps to move in the direction you want them to. Is there any danger, you think, in the short term, at least, to folks, you know, calling for, I don't know, restoring the school-to-prison pipeline or going back to zero tolerance or some of these things that, as Chief Butler already indicated, don't work all that well?
Well, I mean,
well, I don't know
it's right for the community. It's understandable, certainly, for them to be concerned about crime. We've seen a tremendous amount of violence lately. But once again, I extend it back to the comparison to cancer. You certainly, when somebody's diagnosed, you immediately go in and you take aggressive action, whether that be surgery or chemotherapy or radiation. You can be very aggressive. For those who are doing these types of mass shootings, we're going to be and remain very aggressive and make quick turns. But candidly, that is inefficient, and that's a very small population of the overall crime. So I think everyone would agree that they would rather see those incidents never happen. The law enforcement's doing a very good job locally and nationally. We catch them. We kill them sometimes on the scene. I mean, here we have these mass shooters who didn't last but minutes, and were quickly taken down. But the real issue is we want to make sure that it never happens in the first place. And that's where the interruption and more of just like you wouldn't want to have cancer in the first place, no matter how good your surgeon is, you'd rather not have surgery at all. So that's where I think that in taking a restorative justice approach, taking more holistic approaches, isn't a zero-sum game. We're not saying that we're doing away with incarceration. We're doing away with tough on crime. We're doing away with the hard reactions to hard situations. What it is saying is that we are recognizing that preventative care, making interruptions earlier, can prevent these dire consequences. And so that's what I think people need to recognize is that, yes, there's going to be a reaction for a quick action. We're making those. People don't realize, I mean, within the last 2 weeks, two people in the Second Circuit, one was sentenced to death for a murder in McCulloch County. Another was sentenced to life for first-degree murder. So we are we're responding very strongly with traditional penalties. But I think it's going to be better 10, 15, 20 years down the road, if instead of just having a high conviction rate, we can actually have a low crime rate where we don't have to have so robust of tools, both in law enforcement and prosecution, because we don't have the crimes happening in the first place. And that's what I think people need to recognize. It's not an either or. Why can't we do it all?
Professor Murphy, got a question here related to demographics and targeting, if we could hear from an email. Pete says, sound like you're about to get into demographics. Tallahassee, of course, being about twice the size of Longmont, where Chief Butler is. But despite our communities, livability and opportunities and the universities and all of the assets that we have, we also have that dubious distinction of having the highest murder rate per capita. I know you can't take the FBI crime stats and compare apples to kumquats here, but still we have a high murder rate here in Tallahassee. We also have the problem of increasing school segregation, racial divisions, the income disparity, those sorts of issues. So how can restorative justice maybe adjust to communities with such various challenges as we have here, using your community connection as a basis for addressing this?
Yeah, that's a great question. That is a challenging issue and one that Community Connections already deals with in an amazing way that I see with my own eyes. The diversity of kids that come through the program is basically the diversity of the kids that generally get in trouble. And they're doing a phenomenal job with that situation because connection is ultimately a human thing. Connection doesn't depend upon the color of your skin. And once you set up an environment that is safe for the kid, it's no longer a matter of relating, and instead – the kid is in the environment, they feel safe, and they see there's a human sitting in front of me who actually is hearing me. Doesn't matter what the color of their skin is, they hear me. And the kid also says, oh, their experience is different from my own, but they hear me, and I'm hearing their difference. And so a lot of great conversations have come out of Community Connections in this regard. Taking this and picking back on the earlier question of like what large cities are tackling restorative justice, there's a great recent NPR article talking about how Washington, D.C. is the attorney general there has embraced restorative justice so much so that they have created a whole wing within their department, hired a bunch of people in which they're actually from the beginning, they're going after cases in a restorative justice way in terms of prosecution rather than your typical punitive way. And I highly recommend Google NPR DC Restorative Justice. It's a really interesting read. And you will see how initially these prosecutors were very skeptical about this idea. That there's a quote in there about, oh, you know, we thought it was just a bunch of hippies, you know, just wanted to get to circle and talk and things like that. But what they found is it works. And then they were persuaded by just the hard facts that it works. And they decided to develop a whole wing of their staff to do just that. And you know, D.C. is certainly not Longmont, and it's certainly not Tallahassee. But it seems that this these kinds of programs are working in a wide diversity of communities. And I think ultimately it's because we're getting back to a fundamental human connection that we all need.
Let's see. We'll hang on here, Larry. I know you're on the line here. We'll wait till we see if we can get an interface. But if I can throw that back to you, Chief Butler, I know that Dr. Murphy's going to say, yeah, we need more partnerships and involvement on a larger scale throughout the community when it comes to volunteer organizations and resources like Big Brothers, Big Sisters, and all of those kinds of folks. Is that part of this equation too, as you see it, to bring in not just the law enforcement and the prosecutorial and the public defender and all that, but you got to get everybody kind of on this train?
Without question, that ultimately is where I think you want to end up. There's a lot of professional systems, people, police, mental health, addiction treatment providers, nonprofits, but there's a lot of people in Tallahassee that I would bet that have a lot of great things going, have gifts to offer, have talents, resources, expertise to offer, and we do a lot of work in our community on surfacing and activating what we call social capital, which is what we just talked about. It gets beyond systems people. It gets neighborhoods. It gets people engaged and involved in different ways. When you want to address the kinds of issues that you see in various communities, if you keep on going down the path that we're going down, we're just going to continue to have this kind of very feudal kind of approach to it. I mean, it just won't work. And so we're very much addressing the whole idea that the community engagement piece has to be significant here. And so whether it's through restorative justice models, whether it's through other kinds of models, the emphasis and the principles are basically the same. And so I will talk more about that when I come to Tallahassee in terms of what that could look like for Tallahassee. But I will say this. You can look at Tallahassee or any community as a problem to be solved, or you can look at Tallahassee and see its possibilities. And so when people say we need stuff to happen, we need to happen now, that is that quick fix approach to how we're going to deal with the issues. And I agree with Mr. Campbell in terms of what he said is we're not throwing away the criminal justice system and what it does. There are people in our communities that need to be separated out from the rest of the community, and that's the work of the criminal justice system. But there are tons of people that we deal with that overload the criminal justice system, burden the criminal justice system, that can't be effectively dealt with by the criminal justice system, that can be much more effectively dealt with by the community in the kinds of ways we're talking about, building different structures, different mechanisms on the order of restorative justice, those with some restorative practices and principles involved, that can very well take care of those issues and let the criminal justice system work more effectively with those people that we need to really deal with.
I think you are being buttressed by our next caller here on Perspectives. Let's see if we can bring Larry into the conversation. Hey, Larry, thanks for calling. Welcome.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
It's been alluded to that something needs to be done on the front end. And what's lacking, I see quite obviously, is that there aren't behavioral counselors in the school system. In a lot of cases, these kids in the first or second grade, they start showing that they have problems. There's nobody to deal with it at. And in a lot of cases, it will take a five-minute conversation to straighten out a child for the rest of their lives. A lot of these kids are in situations where they're being raised by single mothers who's having to work one or two or three jobs just to keep the food on the table and rent paid. But they say they don't have the money for having the cash. You've got to find the money. We've got money to build $7.5 million bridges across the street for people to walk on or ride their bicycles. We should certainly have the funds to put counselors in the school system. You deal with these kids when they need it the most, and it won't develop to that. The other thing that I find a problem with is we know that people are incarcerated, have drug problems, and then they're released, but they are, in a lot of cases, they're not mandated to be tested to find out if they are still using or not. And if that be the case, the onus should not be on them to pay for those tests. That's something that the community needs to absorb. It's a very cheap investment for the good outcomes that will come of that. It's much more I could get into, but we're running out of time. So if those could be addressed, I think it would deal with a great deal of the problem in the first place.
Thanks so much, Larry. Really appreciate that. Good points all. And Jack Campbell, if I can ask you, did you catch everything Larry said there, or do you need me to kind of give a rundown?
No, absolutely. I think he's right on point. And that's what we're trying to do here is I agree that this is part of the result of the poverty, whether we like it or not. We need to recognize that the Second Circuit of Florida is an economically segregated community. We have a lot of people who are hurting and trying to keep make ends meet, and they're not able to spend as much time as they would like with their children. So I agree that the earlier that we can go in there and have somebody make an impact, you're going to save a lot on the back end. And the same with the addressing. That's what, again, why we're looking at wraparound. If it's a substance abuse issue, let's try to address that. If it's an ACE issue because of trauma, which has been spoken of, let's try to help the child work through so that they don't act out violently and they can find a better way other than crime. And a little bit of prevention really does come back with exponential returns on investment.
Second Judicial Circuit State Attorney Jack Campbell, thanks so much for joining us, Jack. Chief Michael Butler, have a safe trip to Tallahassee. We will see you on the 19th of August at the Good Samaritan United Methodist Church out there on Capitol Circle Southeast from 7 until 9 o'clock. And Dr. Jeremiah Murphy with Community Connections, thank you for being part of the discussion, too, on restorative justice today.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, thanks so much. Perspectives produced by WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. Evan Rossi and Lydell Rawls behind the glass today. And I'm Tom Flanagan. Harvest season is upon us next week. We'll entertain a tasty discussion on our growing scene of farmers markets. We'll talk about it all next week here on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.